From Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, this is East Central Europe Past and Present. I'm Holly Case of the History Department at Cornell, and occasionally we have scholars to our campus to present their work on East Central Europe and interact with students. This blog series will bring you their views on the past, present, and future of the region and how scholars approach it. So today I'm speaking with a Cornell native, namely Claudia Verhoeven, who is assistant professor of history here at Cornell and the author of a book entitled The Odd Man Karakozov, Imperial Russia, Modernity, and the Birth of Terrorism, which was published by Cornell University Press in 2009. Claudia joined the Cornell history faculty in the fall of 2009, and I, for one, am very glad to have her here. Welcome, Claudia.
Thank you.
So your book deals with the attempted assassination of Tsar Alexander II by the odd man Dmitry Karakozov in 1866. The book, if I may say so, is unorthodox and exceptionally creative in its methodology and style, and therefore likely to be misunderstood. In fact, reading existing reviews of it, I feel pretty confident in saying that it already has been misunderstood, at least by one reviewer who referred to it as postmodern. Perhaps we could begin by talking about what you wanted to do with this book and how you would characterize it.
Okay. All right. So it's a really difficult question for me, and I will say why. So basically, when I was coming up with the title for the book, and I think at the same time I had to come up with a sort of a short narrative about what kind of a book this was and what kind of a history it was, and I realized that I didn't know. So I could only come up with really bulky things. It is a micro/cultural/material culture book, and that obviously sounded awful. Then I thought about what is this? Okay, it was a history of an event. And then I thought, well, no, it was an eventful history. And in any case, I went through a lot of things. I couldn't come up with anything with anything satisfying. Also, I think when I was doing the research for it, when I was in Moscow, there was a period during which I referred to it as nano history, because it was not even micro. It was so small that it deserved a smaller word. And so, okay, now none of those. I'm not sure, but basically, I do think. So there are two things I want to say about this. One is that I do think that the kind of history that it is combines certain methodologies or approaches from the last 20 years. I don't. That's obviously not unusual, but I will say which ones those are. And but the other thing is that I think that eventually I did begin to think of the book as a kind of a return to a traditional history, in the sense that. What this book is about is a singular event, singular political event by an individual, right? And so in that sense, a kind of a traditional political history, let's say. On the other hand, it is an illegal political event that is being documented, and the individual is unusual or. Not a legitimate political actor, let's say, right? So, but I do think that since narrative, or the question of narrative, was really important for me while writing this book, yeah, I do think of it as a kind of a return to perhaps an older historiographical tradition. Okay, so that said, I think it is a book that very much comes out of a moment, sort of a moment of transition between, say, the dominantly discursive studies of the 1990s, and then the moment thereafter when there was a return to material culture. So, and for me, I think that this transition took place for various reasons. Well, there were very concrete reasons for this, I think. So one of them was that. When I was in the, okay, I guess I should say something a little bit back up for a second and say what kind of a study this was supposed to be originally when I went into the archive. So originally it was supposed to cover a much longer period. I was interested in the emergence of terrorism as a concept in the second half of the 19th century, or in fact from the 1860s to World War I, essentially. And so Russia, traditionally seen as the birthplace of terrorism, I was interested in seeing how Russians had reacted to this new form of political violence and how they had sort of discursively constituted this political phenomenon. So I was interested in looking at how the press talked about this violence, how literature created terrorist characters, how during political trials the prosecution characterized the terrorists and their violence, and so forth. But then when I went into the archive, what happened was that I started sort of at the beginning with the Karakozov case, about which I knew very little, and perhaps this is also a side effect of how the case was investigated at the time, because it was very it was done in a very secretive manner, right? So Karakozov, as soon as he had been arrested, he sort of disappeared behind bars, and then what happened, because it was such a shocking event, was that there was a cacophony of what was unleashed, right, in response to the event, where everybody was speculating about who was this guy, why did he do it, was he part of a conspiracy, yes or no, what was his character like, and so forth. And sorry about that. So I think there was something about reading through all this at the time. I became very frustrated with the sort of layers and layers and layers of language on top of, you know, I wouldn't say the real Karakozov, but in any case, I was really feeling a lack of access to him and his motivations and his material world. And the other thing that happened was that that was the first thing. The other thing that happened is when I first went into the archive, I think I was very ill prepared for doing archival work, and I had not expected that my sources would be handwritten. And on top of that, many of the sources were written by people who had just been interrogated or who had just been arrested, who were being interrogated on a daily basis, who were under severe psychological duress, and their handwriting was not great. So I suffered a lot trying to decipher it. But I think it was precisely the fact that it was so hard for me to read it that because of that I began to pay attention to very different things about my sources. So maybe not really necessarily what they said even, but rather what they looked like. Or I really began to think much more about the texture or the materiality of words and the production of words, and I began to pay attention to very different things that I found. I sort of very naturally transitioned towards paying attention to objects that were either discussed or listed or included in my sources, right? Because sometimes there were actual objects included, so pieces of hair that had been cut off from the guys who had been arrested, or bits and pieces of the powder that was or was not poisonous that they had carried on their bodies when they were arrested. So many of them had poison hidden in their hair or in their buttons or in their boots, because they were all afraid that they would be tortured while in prison, and so that they would have the option of sort of bowing out of life. So I began to think about these objects, and sort of that made its way into my research. And then the other thing is that I do think that, you know, we're always part of a particular academic and intellectual context, and there was a sort of a turn towards the material that was happening in the late 90s and the early 2000s, and that I sort of rode that wave. And so that's why I think the chapters in the book are at least a part, or that even in those cases where I'm talking about rhetoric or sort of verbal reactions or newspaper reactions to the event, that there's always also a layer of material history that sort of attaches to it. So if it is about newspaper representations, it's also about how these newspapers were being distributed, say on trains or in how many in well, that wasn't very clear, but in any case, that I did try to sort of bring things back down to the ground, so to say.
Thanks. So I know what my favorite parts I would say of the book are, and they are the places. I think maybe chapters is it chapter 4 about Raskolnikov?
Yeah.
And is it 7 about
Priest?
Yes. Where you show that even people who weren't revolutionary thinkers were kind of straining against the nature and pervasiveness of the autocracy, and the creativity and the subtlety with which that is done. But one of the things that I wanted to hear from you is in this final version, was the biggest challenge that you faced, or the biggest problem that you felt like you had to solve, and how did you end up? Well, in the book, let's
okay.
say. So not the dissertation and not, you know, in your preliminary thinking, but for what we got, you know, what was the part of what we got in the book that represented the biggest challenge for you, and how did you sort of resolve it?
Oh, okay. That's funny, because I know there are two moments that were incredibly difficult for me to write through, and it's bizarre that one of them I've repressed at the moment, but I will think of it. But it's one of them is precisely in chapter 4. That's weird that I don't remember, because because the writing of it was so intense. So the one of them was in the introduction. And I believe it is in the section called argument. So I guess it is the hardest for me to work out about this book was the argument. I think that the moment in chapter 4 that I had such a difficult time with is the same structurally, and I don't know that I'm going to be able to discuss it properly or explain it properly, because I think there were certain things about this book that were so difficult for me to think through and I had such a hard time formulating them, and spent so much time sometimes, you know, even on a sentence, that now I think, you know, I don't know if I can say it better than it says it there, but I'm going to try to explain. I don't know if I can. So the moment in the introduction is this, where there is sort of the argument says, this is not the argument about modernity. This is the argument about what terrorism is, and it's a sort of two-prong argument, I think, in one paragraph, where I say, okay, on the one hand, this is about the construction of terrorism, and how reactions to the event, how from the reactions to the event, there emerged a more or less stable concept of what terrorism was, even though terrorism as a term was not yet applied to it, right? I mean, we do have terroristic, terrorizing, and so forth, but terrorism, really, that's, you know, about a decade later, but that all the ingredients of what we think of as modern terrorism, mostly to do with, you know, the way the organization is structured, the nature of the conspiracy, the task of the assassin, right, which include there's a double death involved of an assassination and a suicide, so there's already a sacrificial element, a kind of means end utilitarian logic that, you know, is usually denounced. So that all of this idea of terrorism, that all of that came out of the way that the state and the courts and the newspaper represented this case, right? So that was the one thing. That was the easy part. Then the other part of it was to say, yeah, but that's not enough, right? And I think this is also the moment where I sort of went further than what was the initial intention of the project, because the initial project was just supposed to be about how this concept was constructed, right? So that would have been the end of the project, but I think that the book goes further than that project, because then I wanted to make another step and say, okay, that's how it was constructed. But I didn't want to say, well, okay, because the problem is that the way, the idea of terrorism that emerged from this reaction was, of course, I mean, it was created by a very particular group of people, right? And it was very slanted, and it was a very negative reading of this. Of this new form of political violence. But I didn't want to just say that it was all a lie and that there is that this violence is something perennial, and that terrorism is just something that is invented and imposed on it, because I do think that there is something very specific and new and modern about terrorism. So after making that argument, I wanted to go back and say, yes, all that was constructed, but there is something else that's going on that we need to get at. There is a kind of, if you will, and that's overstating it, a kind of, you know, true nature of terrorism. And in order to understand that, we need to go back to Karakozov and see how he is, how he functions in his environment, both his ideas, sort of the rhythms of his life, the way he is. The how he's part of the fabric of that particular historical moment, and how that moment relates to modernity. So anyway, I hope that was clear, but the point is that to write that was very difficult for me, and I don't even know why, but I guess because it was a kind of weird back and forth movement, or because I was trying to uncover, I don't know, I'm just going to stop while I'm maybe just
I'm very glad that you mentioned this, because this is the sort of the crux of my next question, which is that, you know, I sort of understand why it was so difficult on the one hand, because one of my favorite aspects of the book is how beautifully crafted it is. Each chapter works beautifully on its own, but each also reinforces the central argument of the book, that something new has taken place with Karakozov's failed assassination attempt. So for me, in reading it, the question came to be, how is it that we as historians come to recognize and draw out the new in history? Not in historiography, but in actual history. So since you've done, in my mind, a better job than anyone I've read thus far in excavating the newness of an event, I would love to hear your insights on the general problem of seeing or recognizing a novel shift in a given historical progression. Like, how do we know when we're seeing something new?
Well, I do think, I mean, it's partially the historiography, right? I mean, you can't do without it. So let's say, okay, terrorism as something new. So I'm not by far the first one to say, you know, terrorism emerged in Russia, right? I mean, it's sort of a truism of the field. Both in Russian history and of Russian terrorism. I don't mean to say that there are no debates on it, but I mean it is one of the classic narratives. So you, in that sense, you sort of you approach that period and you already know that there's going to be something new. So in that sense, you're looking for it, right? But that's only part of it. I think that. I mean, in a sense, as historians, we're always, well, I don't know, not always, but in any case, the second half of the 20th century, right? I mean, or say, let's say, starting with the Annales school and the social history and so forth, we're trying to uncover untold stories or uncover the lives and worlds of people who were previously marginalized by, you know, dominant historiographical trends and so forth. And so in that sense, we're always looking for something new, right? Or something to expand the field or something. But I think the one of the big problems is, for me usually, is that, okay, let's say that you really find something new, right? And I do think that Karakozov is new, and I think one of the reasons why I was so interested in it is that it was clear to me from reading the sources that there was something weird about him, because he was just completely misunderstood, right? No, but I mean, people really were agape, right? I mean, they stood before something that I think before that really had been unthinkable. And I think there are moments in history where things happen that are unthinkable, in part. And so that's one thing, right? So you do have to read the sources from the period, and you know, they will give you the clues about what people at the time in any case thought of as new, and you do rely on the historiography. But let's say, okay, so then you found something new, or something that hasn't been told, or something that has been told but not in the way that you think makes it interesting. Then the question becomes, I think the bigger problem is, I remember also something else I wanted to say. Well, anyway, okay. So I think the bigger problem is, how do you narrate that thing, you know, in such a way that you make clear not only to your reader that it was new at the time, that it's important for the historiography, but that in such a way that you don't immediately reintegrate it into the common narrative, right? I mean, in other words, the new should serve as a way of dislocating the common narrative and of turning it upside down, or in any case, providing a perspective from providing a place from which you can look at the old narrative from awry, right, and see it in a new way. So it's an exercise in estrangement, I think, but it's incredibly hard to do that through language, because you can't. It for me, it doesn't work simply when you say, okay, look, you have to see it like this, right? That's not enough. So you have to do it. You have to do it through language and style, and that's so hard. And I don't know how you achieve that ultimately, other than just through trying over and over again and experimenting with words. But that's So how do you, but I also think that there's something intuitive about knowing when something is new or when something is different, and it sort of it reminded me. It's funny, in a seminar that I took at UCLA with Giorgio Agamben at one point. I think it was at the very end of the seminar, and somebody asked him, you know, but Giorgio, how do you? I probably was like, how do you recognize the dialectical image or something like that, right? And so, but it may not have been a dialectical image. Maybe it was something else. But he said, You know it the way a woman knows which dress to wear to the party, you know. And it was sort of, you know, what is the best dress to wear to the party? It's, you know, it's both classic and it has to fit in, but it also has to stand out in a certain way, right? So you just know, it's sort of a sense for fashion. But I also think that it is, but there's, so that's one way of thinking about it. I think the other way of thinking about it is, this is going to get a little, well, all right, fine. Is that the way in what people who have tried lucid dreaming will tell you, right? So when you're dreaming, how do you manage to wake up in a dream and begin to manipulate your dream, right? Some people can do this in sort of half-wake state. Is that they will tell you that you have to look for the thing that doesn't make sense. Right. So the one thing that's going to tell you that sticks out. And so I tried this for a long time. In fact, while I was working on my, before the research, in fact, but, and I was really bad at it, and it took me months to learn how to do it. And then after a little while, I forgot how to do it again. But in any case, but I remember that after months of trying, that I was dreaming, and suddenly in my dream, there was someone with a giant ear. And so I thought to myself, that doesn't make sense. No one can have one giant ear. And at that moment, I knew I was dreaming, and everything changed in the texture of the dream, right? I saw everything as if totally new for the first time, and then I was able to manipulate things. And I think it's the same thing. You just have to train yourself by reading very slowly and, you know, deeply and for a long time in the period that you're studying. And then you will just know it at some point when something is new, and then you have to write it. Okay.
Yes, there's that little detail. But now at least I'm comforted as to, you know, why it is that I haven't managed to do this. It's because I also don't know how to pick dresses. The next question is somewhat related because you've been talking about, the course that you took with Giorgio Agamben, and you mentioned being at UCLA. And so I was wondering if you could be a bit more systematic in telling us who you feel the primary influences on your research and writing so far have been, and in what ways have they sort of moved you in different directions.
Okay. So I sort of have a small list, I think, of people and their ideas and who serve different purposes, let's say. In terms of the, say, let's say, dead thinkers, right, who are important for me, when I first came to UCLA, my first research paper in a course on religion and German culture with David Sabian. My first research paper was on Carl Schmitt and on how he describes the process of secularization. And I think that a number of concepts from his works in the 1920s became extremely important to me and still are. And I work with them and I sort of think through them, even if that's not always explicitly stated in the text, or if sometimes, I mean, these are not questions, and I want to stress this, that I have answered, right, or things that I have that I'm done thinking about. So some of them I can even say I don't understand. And that's true for the other most important thinker, Walter Benjamin, as well. So, but I think that Carl Schmitt, for me, that was, it was kind of logical because when I first came to UCLA, so my background, in fact, was not in history, it was in philosophy. And I think my last semester at Berkeley, I took a course on Heidegger, another thinker that really threw me, who really threw me for a loop. But there were very similar things going on for me in Heidegger, but in philosophy and Carl Schmitt and in politics or political theory or politics in history. So it was kind of a transitional moment, I think, for me to go into thinking historically. So it's through Schmitt and his questions or his concepts just became crucial for me. And I sometimes think that maybe Schmitt poses very similar questions in theory, for me in any case, as Dostoevsky does in literature. And so Dostoevsky is another one. It's just different ways of approaching similar big questions that I don't know how to answer. And then so those two important. And then, like I said, Walter Benjamin. That was I came in the summer of 2001. So to Cornell to do the School of Theory and Criticism. And it was, in fact, supposed to be a seminar with Giorgio Agamben, but he canceled at the last minute. He was replaced by Fred Jameson, and it was a seminar on the Arcades Project. And I had read bits and parts of Benjamin in, and specifically the theses on the philosophy of history, and I had already, for myself at that point, I think, connected that there was an important connection between Schmitt and Benjamin, but I hadn't thought about it systematically at all, and I hadn't read systematically in Benjamin at all. But the Arcades Project as a book really, I mean, completely was for me a huge encounter and turned everything. Well, I don't know. I think it did. I sort of drowned in that book for about a year, if not longer. And I spent a lot of time with it, and I was incredibly inspired by it. And for a long time, I really was going around thinking everything through Benjamin to the extent that I understood it, and sort of. And I think there's a lot of Benjamin in my book, although, again, I sort of managed after a long time to sort of comb out the knots, so that unlike the way I talked at the time, which was every sentence beginning with "according to Walter Benjamin," or "in the Arcades Project," that I sort of managed to sort of comb that out. And so there are still a couple of clues or references that's what it's really all about, so to say. Even, I mean, it's not, but in one of the chapter titles, for example, so many things in an overcoat comes from one of the citations in a particular convolute. But I was very, I think that book to me is shows so much courage and creativity, I mean, intellectually, but also in the writing. So I think that would be the most important. And then I think, and then there, and then I had a, couple of teachers whose work was very important to me. So basically, for different reasons, the members of my committee, so Irina Paperno, Stephen Frank, and David Sabian, and Carlo Ginsberg, who was not on my committee, but who was really, really important to me. I took two small classes with him, and it was in fact during my first seminar with him, which was right before my research to Russia, that I began for the first time to experiment with writing. So he gave us very small writing assignments per week, and for some reason I decided to kind of start experimenting. I think it started with sort of like fonts and bold or italicized or these kinds of things. I don't know if whether it was okay, but I just did. And anyway, it was. But that class was very important to me. Also because I think it was one of the moments when that was maybe theoretically also or methodologically one of the moments when I tried to move away from just sort of the surface to the text, to sort of what is beyond that. And maybe it was a moment when my faith was restored. I can't. That's a terrible choice of words, but okay. Anyway, that you know that there was something beyond the text, right? So because a lot of his work is all about the leaks in the text, and the leaks always lead to other worlds. And of course, yes, those are also discursively constructed and so forth. But I think this is also where writing comes in. So if you position the different worlds or in a proper way with respect to one another, then there can be something about the difference between those representations that gives us access to something other than, you know, what appears first on the surface. So, yes.
So you represent, in my mind, an oddity in a nice way, in a traditionally area studies driven field. I mean, a lot of the study of Russia was initiated, driven by the events of the Cold War. And your research shows, on the one hand, how deeply familiar you are with Imperial Russian history, but your book never once, as I recall, seeks to embed the Karakozov story in a uniquely Russian historical trajectory. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong here. And you also use archives and you talk about politics, but you never slip into reeling off a kind of pat political history or doing what I would call standard contextualization. So I get the feeling that you're not so much, because in other people's hands, I would get this this feeling that the person in question was rejecting a series of scholarly models. But in your case, I get the feeling that it's not so much a rejection of existing scholarly models, but an embrace of alternative ones. And I was wondering, this might be a question that sort of that ramps it back a little bit. But I was wondering what you feel or how you see the implications of your work for the field of Russian history, or how you see the possibility to think about Russian history differently, your relationship to Russian history.
Okay, well, I think it's really funny because, okay, again, to go back to, you know, the trouble with my title, right? When the title was under discussion, and I think that, you know, the press had already approved The Odd Man Karakozov, and I was very surprised because I thought that they would say no way, because it says it's odd and no one knows, you know, who this guy is. But okay, but then came the question of sort of the subtitle, and then they said that Russia should be in the title, and I said, what are you talking about? This book is not about Russia, you know. I didn't tell them that because I really, but it was funny that was my first reaction because, I mean, of course it's completely, I don't know, but I think it is because, I think it's because I sort of, well, there are two reasons, right, why it is. One is that I think that maybe I am, although I am really concerned with the historiography of the revolutionary movement specifically and of revolutionary terrorism, both in Russia but also outside of Russia. But on the other hand, I feel that maybe the questions that I was working through in that book were not necessarily Russian questions. questions, right? I think they were questions maybe that came out of, like I said earlier, you know, something that I didn't get in Carl Schmitt, for example. Or, I mean, to give a very specific question, and I don't know why Agamben keeps coming up, but in any case, he talks about this, but the sort of relationship between Schmitt and Benjamin on the discussion on the nature of the exception and states of emergency, right? I had thought about this. I thought about this not through Agamben, but before I even went to the archives, right? That this was it just a matter of perspective, i.e., when you see violence, the nature of the violence depend on if you're sort of looking top down or bottom up, or is there something else going on? And I was very interested in this, and I think that terrorism was, you know, kind of was a way for me to try to think through that, right? So that's what's going on. There are a number of questions like that in there, or maybe questions that Dostoevsky had raised for me, but that I didn't necessarily think of as Russian questions. I think the other thing is that, you know, my training, like I said, first I studied philosophy, but then my graduate training, there was a lot of just pan-European and especially German history. In fact, I kind of fled eventually from German history into Russian history because there were certain questions I just couldn't deal with, right? I was originally going to write about the Weimar period, and I couldn't deal with the fact that everything for me, that I was constantly hitting up against the Nazi question, essentially. I just was not, but so I fled, and then, but I think I brought those questions with me, so to say, and they reappeared in a different form. So that is maybe why there's not so much. And I think, you know, some people have critiqued it for this, right, the book, or some people think that that's not a good thing about the book, that there's not enough engagement with the broader historiography. But in any case, so right, well, from but seen from within, you know, the field. So okay, so how will it affect, or what is the relevance of the book to Russian history? You know, I don't know. I'm really not sure. I don't know that I would dare to say anything about that. And I'm not sure that I wrote it in order to make an impact on, you know, I mean, to the extent that we make, you know, impacts with the books. But I mean, you know, on Russian historiography. No, that's not true. I wanted a return to revolutionary history, the revolutionary tradition, which has not been very popular for the last 20 years. I think it's really important, this period. I'm happy that people are working on that now. I think that people are working on it in very innovative ways. And I think, you know, that is so if the book contributes to that, then I would be happy. So okay.
That raises a question of, you know, what kinds of things you've read that have come out lately, not necessarily exclusively in Russian history, but in all areas of history and or other fields, that you think really represent, you know, here's what can be done, here's what's interesting now.
I guess that the book, maybe one of the books, well, maybe the book that I thought was most interesting the last few years was Benedict Anderson's Under Three Flags. And I do think that you know, you can see that as a continuation of the argument in the first book, right, in Imagined Communities. But I think it's, but it is very different. And but I think one of the reasons why I like it is because it is also, it has a clear concern with narrative and style. So it's well written, and it's the narrative is methodologically interesting, I think, right? It's not just nice writing, right? There's something else going on there, And also, he manages, he kind of manages in that book, there are a few moments when you really suddenly see the familiar old world in a new way. And he manages that through, through what I think is a very successful kind of global history stories within this global history of anarchism. I think that that book succeeds. So that one. I don't know. Anything else? No.
So I would love to know more about where you intend to go from here with your research. I mean, what kinds of things are you thinking about now, and how you envision your next project? Even though I know with these things that they always mutate under, you know, once we start working on them. But just where you are in your thinking now about your next project.
Okay. So my next project initially. I thought that, initially, that is when I filed the dissertation, I thought, and now for something very different. And I thought, very different to me at the time meant counter-revolutionary, so that's not very, very clever, but okay. Anyway, I abandoned that completely, that idea. I wanted to work on Joseph de Maistre at the time, but anyway, I do think it's very interesting, but that's not what I want to work on. So I am continuing to work on terrorism and political violence, and I think there's sort of three different strands that are emerging at the moment, and I'm not sure yet in which form I will complete these projects or whether I will complete all of them. So the first is that through the work of the first book, I became really interested in questions of temporality and sort of how terrorists think about time and historical time, and how they think of violence as an instrument to change time, to either accelerate history or to inaugurate a new time, so to say. But also terrorist experience of their daily life, right? And the rhythms of their daily life, so to say, and how those two are connected. So I just finished one article on that, and so that's sort of the core problem that I'm interested in. And then the way that will work itself out in a book length project is yet undecided. So it might be a Russia only project, and I think that there are grounds for doing that because there's a lot of material to work with. And for example, there are these weird stories by people like Nikolai Morozov, who he spends 20 years in solitary confinement after having been a theorist of terrorism for the People's Will, and he writes these weird science fiction stories about involving revolutionaries time traveling and so forth. So, but that's just one example. But there's tons of stuff that's really fun. I've also thought about turning that project into a transnational history, where it wouldn't look necessarily at violence, but it would look at various forms of irregular violence and in different national context, and sort of link them to different political thinkers. So that's another way. The next immediate thing that I want to think about is more about a smaller project, well, difficult but shorter, I think, about the connection between, or sort of one way about thinking of politics and aesthetics. So I'm beginning to think about terrorism I'm trying to figure out whether it's possible to think about terrorism, broadly speaking, revolutionary terrorism, as a political modernism. So whether it's possible to place terrorism sort of side by side with the development of aesthetic modernisms in the mid-19th century to sort of the early 20th century. So, but I'm mostly going to be working on that next year as part of a writing group here at Cornell.
Great. So that's my last question. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
come again.